Welcome to History 101, Lecture 12, Missionaries to the Four Corners of the Earth. Now, to return to our distinction between book, customary, and community religions, one of the main problems book religions have, apart from the distinction between ministers and prophets, and religious virtuosi, and the routine priesthood, who minister by the sake of diplomas, is the constant tension and the cleft between the esoteric book knowledge of these religions and the life world of the wider community of believers. This is institutionalized in Hinduism, where obviously religion is a matter of a hereditary priestly caste who command an ancient, arcane language, Sanskrit, a language completely opaque to the masses of believers. The distance between high Hinduism and folk Hinduism is to some extent breached by devotional movements whose writings are in the vernacular and whose prophets do not necessarily have to be Brahmin. Yet this remains a problem for book religions throughout. Thus, for example, many book religions have a tendency for the services to be done in some archaic tongue, which the community does not grasp at all. Thus, services in the Ethiopian Orthodox Church are performed in Ge'ez, an ancient variety of Amharic that dates back to the 6th century, and that is meanwhile so different from Amharic that the Bible had to be retranslated into Amharic in the 19th century. Again, services in the Armenian church are done in Grabar, or Old Armenian, that similarly nobody but the clergy understands. While the language of the Orthodox Church is Church Slavonic, similarly opaque to believers, and in the Catholic Church it's obviously Latin. And while the Quran is obviously no major hurdle for an Arabic speaker, it is clearly for non-Arabic speakers, who have to cram as a child often completely meaningless passages in an ancient, archaic language. To quote an extreme example, Muslims in Kerala, often rated illiterate in Malayalam, may often quote entire passages from the Quran by head. They may even be literate in Arabic, but not in their own tongue. It is arguable that one reason administrations in West Africa never proceeded to doing their administration in their own language was that there was already an alternative available to developing one's own idiom, Arabic. Thus the Ashanti administration was partly done in Shvi, not committed to writing, and partly in Arabic, sometimes committed to writing. There is thus, in all book religions, a gap between the high form of the religion, only clear to a very limited number of religious specialists, who have, I might say, an interest in making the religion as incomprehensible as possible, precisely to preserve their monopoly on the exercise of the religion, and to present their acts as a kind of mystery to common believers, and thus too as a form of magic, and the broad body of believers, who are, as it were, excluded out of the inner mysteries, indeed, the meaning and the inner sanctum of their own religion. Commonly, therefore, there is a gap in book religions between what the religious intellectuals think is the meaning of the religion and what the community of believers think the right practice of the religion are. This is particularly so in largely illiterate societies. Thus, to take a contentious example, the practice of female incision, removal of the clitoris, is a widely spread traditional African practice, but there is nothing in the Islamic law sanctioning it. As, however, Somali tribesmen adopted Islam in the 15th century, one way of distancing themselves from non-Islamic groups was to stress female incision, so that over time Islam, female incision, became linked. So much so that Somali intellectuals nowadays commonly think it is prescribed by the Quran and will fiercely resist attempts to abolish it. Again, central to the observance of Islam in Jaffa are spirit media, who possess supernatural spirits that come directly from the prophets or from close friends of the prophets, and that arrive in both human and animal form. These Islamic saints, when possessed by these powers, perform in trance. They are accompanied by traditional Javanese music, and they perform what may be called stunts. They eat glass or they climb in trees. This is seen, in traditional Javanese Islamic thought, as being in close communion with Allah. Now, while this has some faint resemblances to mystical practices in the Arabic countries, such folk practices are criticized by modernizing Islamic movements in Java nowadays as completely contrary to the spirit of the Quran, as in my estimation they are. There is also a tension between folk and intellectual schools. To take a familiar example of a folk cult that is gradually being transformed into and fused with official religion, Juan Castillo Morales, who served as a soldier in the border town of Tijuana and was executed in 1938, his followers say on faked accusations, is now widely seen as patron saint of illegal Mexican immigrants to the United States. Juan's burial spot has become a place of pilgrimage for migrants who pray for his intercession when trying to cross the US border. His grave is adorned with flowers and green cards of people who have made it into the USA. The church still hesitates to beatify him, but that will surely come sooner or later, lest the Morales cult develops into a dangerous sect, as has happened with the followers of Simon Kimbango in the Congo, as we shall see in a later lecture. Now, there are broadly five ways in which book religions may react on folk practices: acceptation, adaptation, accommodation, prohibition, and erasure. Acceptation means that a folk practice is wholesale adopted into the religion. Much as spirit possession is sanctioned by and even seen as all important to Islam by most Islamic scholars in Jaffa, so too the celebration of Christmas just happens to coincide in time and date with the Roman celebration, Saturnalia, described by one Roman writer as the time of well-laden tables, when a stream of presents to one another pools out on all sides. And the greatest quality of that festival is that it teaches people not to hold too fast to money. It all sounds very familiar, doesn't it? Second, there is adaptation. Practices are somewhat revised to conform more closely to the religion. This is obviously the common practice. Thus, in our Javanese example, traditional Javanese Hindu practices have been somewhat adapted to fit into an Islamic worldview. And it is obviously also how the meaning of Saturnalia has been somewhat shifted to accommodate it as a Christian celebration. Third, there is accommodation. That is, the established religion tends to more or less ignore previous practices. It condones elements of older religions as an ornament or a harmless element of culture, or, as in the 19th century they would put it, folklore. Thus, for example, the ubiquitous green man, faces surrounded by leaves and looking like a tree, which are everywhere peeping from the pillars of medieval cathedrals, go back to the Celtic spirits of the woods, but were apparently condoned by the medieval church as mere ornaments. Then again, there is prohibition, and finally, there is erasure, trying to destroy a folk practice by erasing the very memory of it. A good example of erasure is the blowing up of Buddha statues of Bamiyan by the Taliban recently. That was perhaps partly an intentional provocation intended to make people in India and in the West angry. But partly too, it was a demonstration that the Taliban would no longer permit the godless licentiousness that prevailed in Afghanistan before. And it was meant to call them to true Islam. It is a good example of the erasure of memory of the Islamic past itself by religious zealotry and zealots in the 21st century, as these statues had been standing there under Islamic rule for 1,000 years, and they had apparently never greatly worried anybody. Now, in medieval Europe, there was very similar, as in the examples just treated, a tension between folk practices of the largely illiterate Christian peasant masses, who had and maintained a broad array of pre-Christian practices of contacting spirits of the netherworld, which could broadly be defined as magic, and that the church either sought to Christianize by adapting them, condoning them, or in the utmost case, erasing them. Many of these practices and beliefs will often be familiar, as they have found their way into either horror movies or children's tales, and they often survived into the more isolated or poorer parts of Europe deep into the 20th century. A classic example is Carlo Levi's classic novel Christo si è fermato a Eboli, where the author, a doctor from Turin, who had been banished by Mussolini to the dirt poor Basilicata province in the 1930s, encounters a peasant world that has a form of Christianity that has remained in Levi's eyes completely pagan. It revolves around spells, witches, witchcraft, werewolves, and charms. And the peasants utterly distrust and loathe the church, to them a mere ally of the landlords. Indeed, the priest they can't even understand, as none of them speaks the local dialect. As another example of magical practices, there is, to but stay with Italian examples of popular magic, the typical Southern European, or perhaps even Mediterranean, because it's found in Islamic countries too, belief in the evil eye, an imminent evil for which one has to protect oneself by spells and amulets. Doors in Mediterranean countries still often have eyes painted above the entrance, and so often have fisher bowls. The origins of this belief are lost in deep antiquity, but they go at least back to the ancient Egyptians. Then again, there is the equally old European idea of the werewolf, attested from Plato right up to Michael Jackson. I personally think that belief goes back all the way to the Ice Ages, and it persisted throughout the Middle Ages and throughout the early modern period. Even the lord Jean Baudin, whom we met already, was dead afraid of werewolves. And he actually wrote a book about it, werewolves, the big bestseller in his time. Rather than all those boring tracts on politics, he also wrote, and for which he is nowadays remembered. Then again, to but stay with the repertoire of the horror movie, there is the Eastern European legend of the vampire. It is supposed to have originally come from India, and it may have traveled together with the Sinti, Gypsy communities, from India to Europe. Again, peasants used an enormous variety of charms and spells with which they communicated with the netherworld. Such charms and spells could be both good and evil. The best known example of a good spell is love potion. For example, Groningen in the Netherlands, in mind you, the 19th century, one teacher could still complain that the peasants there only believed in secrets and spells. Secrets and spells they do not understand, whereas everything that can be made clear to them by reason, they will immediately reject. Peasants in Groningen believed fevers were caused by witches, and that they could be combated by throwing a piece of peat with magical signs into a fire. If a cow gave no milk, or a child was ill, that was caused by evil spells as well. If the pillow of a sick child was examined, and it contained curled threads, then the child had surely been bewitched. Again, if somebody was ill, a way of finding out was putting a key in a Bible, putting the Bible on a string, and turning it to see whether it would turn in the direction of a witch. Again, if somebody was ill, it was common to call on a professional exorcist, mostly an elderly lady, and surely everybody believed in ghosts, the white witches, who in Groningen indeed looked like the ghosts familiar from any cartoon. Now, most of such practices were condoned by the church and partly adapted by the church. There was a higher sphere of sorcery and witchcraft that was not only adopted by the church, but in which clergymen, and particularly the parish clergy, who of course little differed from peasants, participated, or which they might practice themselves. Thus, for example, priests commonly practiced exorcism and expulsion of demons. It was a practice in which the high church believed too. Yet, such priests had always to dread potential lay competitors. And, above all, such practices easily shaded off into heresy, or even into what the church might brand Satanism. For Christian religion and witchcraft shared two beliefs. First, the belief in a direct relationship between the natural and the human. The macrocosm is a reflection of man, and hence all things, stars, herbs, stones, the elements, mess with man, and they influence his psyche or his body. And second, Christianity and witchcraft share the belief that suffering is due to somebody's moral fault, commonly the sufferer's own, though God might inflict it for reasons only known to himself. Commonly the church said that either the unfortunate himself or the community was to blame. Similarly so, in magic, fairies and ghosts were likely to torment somebody who had failed in his social duties. Church and magic thus both served to reinforce social control. Now the Reformation had in this respect a rather curious effect. On the one hand, in the Protestant countries, the Reformation removed the saints or the images of the saints, such as the Black Madonna of Shestakowa, who had so far, as it were, interceded between a natural and a human realm. That gap was to an extent filled by sorcerers, by magicians, and by witches. In times of plague, for example, one English theologian noted in the mid-17th century, people fled for remedy to saints. Some fled to the arts of witchcraft. For many believers, the Protestant doctrine of self-help in religious matters was too austere, for, as one author in the 17th century remarked, if most believers really believed all good or bad things came from God, why did they then still need to resort to charms and witchcraft? And the church came to distinguish between black magic, the practitioners of which were in league with the devil, and learned or spiritual magic that was tolerated and widely practiced at European courts, a few only reinforced by Protestant attacks on Catholic saints or on Catholic altars as demonic. On the other hand, however, the period, and particularly the period after about 1540, also featured an increasing pressure on both clerics and laymen to conform to the notions of the church that historians nowadays call confessionalization, and that broadly went through a couple of stages. First, the purification of the doctrine of the church to clearly distinguish itself from other churches. Then followed the enforcement of orthodoxy of personnel in key positions, clergymen, teachers, midwives, for example. Then there was propaganda and censorship. Then followed the internalization of new norms by education, and finally these norms were enforced by the authorities of both church and state. And this was both intended to educate the population as to remove vice through the inculcation of the church's catechism, moral surveillance and regulation of daily life. Thus, for example, in Protestant Strasbourg, the community strove to regulate daily life in the service of the gospel. It would prohibit vices as swearing, blasphemy, dancing, gambling, drunkenness or prostitution. Even in the early 20th century, the monthly house visit of the Catholic pastor was the terror of any Catholic family in the southern Netherlands, as the pastor carefully inspected whether Mary was on the right place, and he might occasionally even inspect the spousal bed, whether his brethren were following their duty of producing enough future members of the Mother Church. Protestant churches have a board of elders who gather weekly, partly to run the affairs of the church, partly to go on house visits to see whether the members of the church live decently, in accordance with the idea of the Christian family. Now, if you want to know what this is, take a little random look at your average TV preacher. He wants basically the entire USA to conform to Protestant family values. Indeed, the entire world to conform to the USA's family values. Those American missionaries easily forget that the USA is at the same time also the main worldwide propagator of pornography. And that's likely the best corrosive force to family values imaginable. There are nowadays twice as many people working in the pornography business in Hollywood than there are in Hollywood's mainstream, and the sales are larger. Since most of that is diffused via the internet nowadays, this is actually the main reason why Iran censors the internet, and not the propagation of democratic values, as American politicians like to imagine, who are, I think, only on the official level, completely oblivious of their porn business. And yes, the porn business targets Iran and Arab countries too. There are, I counted it, at least 35,000 clips on the internet that are specifically made for Muslim audiences. But let's return to the 16th century. The aim of confessionalization was thus to impose the kind of increased controls on individual behavior that Norbert Elias called the civilizing process. This civilizing process as much amounted to inculcation of the church's values on the religiously indifferent as to inculcation of respect for the government, that after all, according to both Calvin and Luther, was directly anointed by God. If Russian revolutionaries later on joked that if German revolutionaries gathered and there were signs, "Do not walk over the grass," they would of course do so, and the revolutionaries would likely have cancelled the meeting altogether, lest they damage the grass, then this has a lot to do with generations of inculcating obedience to both church and state by confessionalization. Confessionalization amounted to an attack too on peasant religious behavior and on witches and magicians. They were branded by the church as practitioners of black magic. In other words, as both Protestant and Catholic Church became increasingly intolerant of dissident views, there was at the same time more demand for magic. As an increasingly austere church, increasingly insisting on precisely following the doctrine, could not quite fill the gap left for explaining everyday suffering. It is towards this background that we should see the so-called Great Witch Craze, that is conventionally dated from 1485, the date of apparition of an infamous book by Catholic clergyman Heinrich Kramer, The Witch Hammer, and that roughly ends in 1650, when the belief in witches gradually began to die out. Though, in the more isolated parts of Europe, the belief of witches persisted deep into the 20th century, and the very last witch trials were held in the 1880s. Now, there is meanwhile a massive literature on this topic, partly, I think, because the topic was sexy, particularly in the 60s and 70s, for two reasons. First, because many historians saw very clear parallels between the witch hunts and the general fear of a communist conspiracy of their own days. And second, because it obviously involved accusations of men against women, so that the witch became a kind of symbol for the feminist movement. I, at least, recall demonstrators for the right to abortion back in the 70s who used to disguise themselves as witches. And for this reason, the topic, of course, attracted many feminist historians. And partly, we know very much about witches, for a very simple reason. Peasant or working-class women tend to be extensively documented in source only if they appear in front of a court of justice. That means sources on women are mostly either about witches or about prostitutes. As a result of all this, the numbers involved in the witch craze have been wildly exaggerated. Figures have been mentioned of 9 million people executed during the witch craze, and even serious historians still used to talk about 250,000. Actually, it seems the numbers were much lower, probably less than 35,000 over a period of two centuries. Furthermore, there were vast regional differences. In the northern Netherlands, less than 100 persons were ever condemned as witches. I say persons, since while 80% of the witches were women, there were a few men. In the southern Netherlands, less than 2,000 persons. In Sweden, less than 1,000. In France, about 3,000. In England, less than 1,000. And in Italy, less than 2,000. And there, all in one region, the desperately poor mountains of Friuli, part of Venice, and where the peasants stuck to very similar ideas as the peasants in the Basilicata. However, the Venetian Inquisition, given the difficult relation Venice had with the Vatican, was a particularly zealous one, so that Venice could show it was a good child of the Mother Church, and it therefore tried to root out heretic beliefs of the so-called Benandanti of Friuli, root and branch. Finally, there were only a few dozen witch trials in Spain, all in a single village in the Basque country, and only a few hundred in Portugal. In effect, the witch craze was primarily concentrated in four regions, southern Germany, Austria, Bohemia, and Hungary, including Ottoman Hungary, where the Ottoman authorities more or less tolerated the lynching of witches by their Christian subjects, but were otherwise skeptical of this odd fashion that had newly come to prevail amongst the unbelievers. Now, the Protestant parson Balthasar Dekker already put forward a perfectly good explanation for the witch craze in 1691, to which I really need to add very little. The problem, Dekker argued, was that particularly in areas contested between Protestants and Catholics, such as were southern Germany, Bohemia and Hungary, both sides on the religious divide were constantly accusing the other of being henchmen of Satan. And this had led to a broad consensus amongst the believers that the entire world was Satan's work, and that henchmen of Satan, demons or evil spirits, were constantly everywhere preying on true Christians. And this was believed as much by the authorities of the church as by the community. This had fused, argued Dekker over time, with a whole set of beliefs that far predated Christianity, and that had in essence little to do with Christianity. For after all, Dekker argued, if souls went to heaven, to hell, or to purgatory, as the church taught, how could that be reconciled with the wide belief in undead ghosts held by the community as much as by the ranking churchmen? To this may be added, perhaps, that at the height of the witch craze, roughly from 1570 to 1640, the entire region of southern Germany, of Bohemia and of Hungary, was in steep economic decline. Former economic hubs, such as Nuremberg or Augsburg, declined to little more than provincial towns. It seems likely that people ascribed fakely understood economic shifts to the work of Satan in general and to witches in particular. They were thus particularly prone to turn in their neighbors as witches too. Because almost everybody questioned as a witch was detained on accusations of their neighbors. Now, did the women accused of witchcraft really believe they were witches? This is a question which is very difficult to answer, partly because in principle torture could be applied against witches, and partly because judicial intimidation by itself already can bring people to confess virtually anything. A clear case are the so-called show trials under Stalin, where the accused voluntarily confessed, without any use of torture, to the most idiotic accusations. That they were German spies, for example, something they could not even remotely have been, and that was clear to both themselves and to their judges. And those confessions, furthermore, were sure to get them executed besides. Now similarly, imagine being interrogated as a poor widow by a whole bench full of learned inquisitors, judges and friars. Such judicial intimidation would by itself virtually suffice to have such a lady confess anything. However, most women accused of being witches were poor, elderly, childless widows. And as there were very few provisions for sustaining them, one of the few ways of making a living was as medicine women, who advised villagers on cures against various dimly understood diseases. That always involved good magic, more or less condoned by the church. But to be particularly potent, medical wizardry has to use black magic too. For, to put it in Star Wars terms, the good side of the Force has some potency of its own, but the dark side is far more powerful and far more attractive. It is therefore likely that many ladies accused of being witches were indeed themselves convinced too they had made a pact with the devil, and that they were possessed by the dark side of magic. Nor is that unique to Europe. In the village of Kambaka, northern Ghana, there is to this very day a community of witches who are not allowed to wander beyond their village, lest they damage the surrounding communities. This has evoked a great deal of anger in the entire Western world, and there has been an action to rescue the ladies of Kambaka. The thing, however, is that the ladies of Kambaka do not want to be rescued, because they themselves are very convinced they are witches, that they are possessed of evil spirits, and they are very proud of it too. To sum it up, from the 16th century onward, Europe itself featured an increasing drive to convert peasant populations of Europe to the true religion. For the elites, they had remained uncivilized pagans. It is namely virtually impossible to exaggerate the contempt urban elites felt for the peasant masses. To give just some French examples, taken from Eugene Weber's justly famous study, Peasants into Frenchmen. These are examples, mind you, from the 19th century, when peasants and officials were, after all, both supposedly equal citizens of the French Republic. Thus, the préfet of the département d'Ariège described his peasant subjects as just as wild as the beers they breed. In the département Four, peasants, according to an army officer, uttered wild cries, just like savages. Another landowner described peasants of the, one might think, quite civilized Loire Valley as vulgar, uncivilized, 2 centuries behind. Another one, the peasants of the, one might think, also quite civilized Limoges region, as animals with 2 feet, but no men. Their clothes are filthy. Under his thick skin, one cannot see the blood flow. Their dull case betray no flicker of thought in their being that is morally and physically atrophied. As the famous Encyclopédie had voiced it in the 18th century, most people
of the elite, the encyclopedia was addressing, see no difference between peasants and animals. This way of thinking is very old, and it will likely endure for a very long time too. Indeed, such vulgar, uncivilized, and morally and physically retarded beings, for which savages was really too good a word, had thus to be brought to faith and civilization, so that the entire process of confessionalization was also, and above all, a process of missions into the rural hinterland of Europe, where clerics, belonging to the middle classes or to the elites, went to spread both the word of the gospel and obedience to the worldly authorities. For, though the 16th century featured the first general outbreak of missionary enthusiasm amongst the Catholic and the Greek Orthodox faith, while the great missiologist Gustav Wernick rightly argued that among Protestants missionary enthusiasm non-existent, most missionaries worked in Europe. Around 1600, the Order of Jesus had 15,000 members. Of them, 3,000 worked in the Americas, and there were 500 to convert the whole of Asia. The rest of the Jesuits were in Europe, and of them, most were in Poland, that by 1600 was, as it were, the most Jesuit-dense country in Europe. Now there was admittedly, and there still is, a very close relationship between missions in Europe and missions abroad. I recall attending a Pentecostal gathering in Amsterdam, where the community was asked to support missionaries in Africa. That seemed to me altogether bizarre, as the entire congregation attending the meeting was African, and there was not a single Dutchman present, except me. However, the church probably felt that missionaries in the Netherlands, clearly far more needed, were not sexy enough. And very similarly, communities in the 16th century got more enthusiastic about distant conversions of heathens or pagans and martyrdoms in strange alien lands than about the dreary work of everyday confessionalization. The tales about the conversion of distant lands particularly encouraged the Counter-Reformation. And indeed, they were arguably a major factor in the success of the Counter-Reformation in Europe. In either way, on the one hand, the Potosi silver, in my view, by and large financed the Counter-Reformation. Yet its successes in Europe also produced zealous missionaries willing to work alien lands. Thus, for example, the southern Netherlands, only just fully brought back into the fold of the Mother Church, next produced most missionaries working in China in the 17th century. Because mission was so important for propaganda, there has been a massive outpour of missionary propaganda ever since the 16th century too. It was everything else written about the non-West. And indeed, this literature was for most Europeans of the 16th and 17th centuries their main window on the non-West. And the literature of the highly literate Order of Jesus was in particular. For the Jesuits were unlike the other orders. Those other orders were to withdraw from this world, but the Jesuits were to work in this world. They would eschew the normal practice of orders to eat and pray together. Rather, they had to travel throughout the world, and they would have to live in any part of it, whatsoever, wherever there was hope, to the greater service of God, as the constitution of the order says. And the Jesuits were to work through education in particular. By 1700, there were 700 Jesuit colleges and universities in America, in Europe, and there was one in Goa, where the Jesuit college was the only European-style university in India up to the foundation of the University of Calcutta in 1857. The Jesuits were furthermore an order that particularly attracted members of both the nobility and the new letrado, a noble of the pen, elite, too. The founder of the order, Ignatius de Loyola, was of course himself of Hidalgo descent, and Cardinal Newman later on described him as the St. George of the modern world, with his chivalrous lance run through his writhing foe, precisely the kind of things Hidalgos would dream of. And furthermore, the order provided both a free education and, by 1590, a way of assessing the rich and the powerful. For at that time, many Jesuits acted as confessors or counselors of kings and nobles throughout Catholic Europe. And that's exactly the kind of thing that would attract letrados or nobles of the pen. Thus, for example, Portuguese possessions in Asia, it is very easy to trace down what the Jesuits were doing, because the Jesuits have left so many writings. On the other hand, I had great difficulties finding out anything about the Dominicans, although there were actually more of them than there were Jesuits. However, the Dominicans were a far more proletarian order than the Jesuits. Most of them were former soldiers or sailors, barely literate, whereas the Jesuits were very upper class, literate people. Now, the conquista of America was done by the conquistadors for God, cult, glory, and the king. And it was far from always clear which or who had priority. The conquistadors, critically, were not modern people. We tend to assume that they were primarily out for material gain, but that was surely only partly the case. In their own perception, the conquistadors came to save the Indians from their worshipping the devil. And here, obviously, the conquista fits into the entire atmosphere of the 16th century. After all, inquisitors persecuting witches were also saving them from the devil. I think the conquistadors took all this very seriously. For example, before they could fight any group of Indians, the rules demanded that a priest step forward and would read them, in Spanish, a declaration that if they repented and converted to the holy faith, they would be spared. Otherwise, the Spanish could fight them. I have never quite understood how the Spanish exactly were supposed to do that, but they always stuck to that rule. Furthermore, the line between Cain and faith was quite fluid. Pizarro, for example, sent his brother Hernando to the sacred oracle Pachamac, near present Lima, in a sacred chamber on top of the pyramid, which no one was to enter except the high priest. Hernando Pizarro walked up the pyramid. He smashed the door, then smashed everything in the sacred chamber, and he took everything else with him. In his own perception, Hernando had smashed demonic images, yet he surely got richer from it too. Nor indeed did the service of God and the king contradict one another. For first the Borgia Pope, and then his successor, Julius XI, had granted the king of Castile virtually unlimited authority over the church in America, by virtue of an earlier rule by which the Pope had granted the Catholic kings far-reaching authority over the churches in the Muslim lands of Granada. For, as I said in an earlier lecture, when the Pope granted that authority in 1508, practically nobody grasped the true magnitude of what the Spaniards had just discovered. In Rome, everybody thought, with the rest of Europe, they had found some insignificant islands and a lot of empty waste and jungle. In that manner was founded the so-called Real Patronato, in which the Spanish crown could name clerics in return for financially supporting the missions, though not the regular clergy that was to be paid by the tithe, just like churches in Europe. In practice, the King of Spain ruled the church in South America by royal decrees, and the secular authorities thus had hold over the church to a degree that was completely unparalleled anywhere in Europe, not even in Moscovy, where the patriarch named bishops. And that gave after independence rise to a massive problem, as the newly independent states of Latin America claimed the Real Patronato had now devolved on them, but the Catholic Church was no longer willing to allow it to them. Indeed, The Catholic Church was generally opposed to independence, although in Mexico the movement was led by priests, as we shall see in later. In the colonial period, however, church and state closely collaborated. To put it very bluntly, if Mexican or Incan peasants were exploited by the encomendieros, then the colonial church was always ready to tell them that was all God's will, and they would be rewarded in the afterlife. In his illustrated New Chronicle and Advice for the Better Government of the Indies from 1605, Quechua noblemen Felipe Guzman Poma de Ayala included the drawing illustrating this lecture. It is of the six ungodly animals feared by the poor Indians of this kingdom, Peru: the royal administrator, a serpent; the itinerant Spaniard, tiger; the encomendiero, a lion; the parish priest, a fox; the notary, a cat; and the native lord, a rodent. And he summarized the common sermons of a priest in the Andes, which his community commonly slept through, though, as he always said the same thing, and many priests did not even speak Quechua besides, as follows, quote, "Now listen to me, men, you bunch of weaklings, sick, greedy, drunken, adulterers, whores, thieves, witches, warlocks. You shall provide me with gold. You, women, fear your friar like a demon, the devil, or inferno. Come and serve me in my house. I'm the supreme lord and the king here, more than the Inca king. I am your judge and lawyer together, and I'm going to hang you. Alas, you do not even deserve my shoes, my little children. Hear this well. God protects me, and you are my very dear and venerable little children. This is what I'm going to teach you in my sermon. I'm your friar. I will protect you." He was the main reason the Catholic Church, when there was no secular authority anymore, immediately evaporated amongst the Quechua-speaking peasants of Cusco during the Tupac Amaru rebellion of 1780, as we shall see later, despite 200 years of indoctrination of the faith. Nonetheless, I should immediately add to that that the Church itself was the severest critic of the practices of the Church. However, the Church had always a somewhat ambiguous relationship with the Indian communities. This is perhaps best epitomized by Franciscan friar Diego de Lamba, who became provincial of the Yucatan mission in 1561, as he had converted tens of thousands of Maya. In that year, de Lamba also became entangled in a prolonged lawsuit, as he was, and rightly, accused of on accusations of satanic practices, having not only put thousands upon thousands of Maya peasants in prison, but personally led investigation by the use of horrendous tortures, in which hundreds of people had died. And yet de Lamba, as he returned to Spain, wrote a long, scholarly account of Yucatan, in which critically he made a detailed description of Maya hieroglyphs. Without his description, they could never have been deciphered in the 1950s by Russian philologist Yuri Kozorov, though his results were typically for that age and that time described as triumphs of Marxist-Leninist science, and therefore immediately dismissed by American philologists as Soviet propaganda, until the age of detente in the 1970s, that is. And yet, while de Lamba made a very detailed description of these hieroglyphs, he said at the same time that any book containing it had been burned immediately, because it had been the work of the devil. So that practically not a single Maya book scroll, of which there were once tens of thousands, has survived the missionaries. De Lamba thus at once loved and abhorred his own Indian flock, although, admittedly, de Lamba had a very difficult province, as unlike the Aztecs, the Mayas put up a prolonged fight against the Spanish. Most of Yucatan was really only subdued in the mid-16th century, and the interior of Belize constituted a kind of Maya refugee zone, one that was to challenge the Spaniards for another 100 years. That was also one reason why almost no Spanish colonists established themselves there, and in Guatemala, another even more Maya province, virtually the only tie between the government in Mexico and the supposedly subdued peasants were the friars, who tried establishing there an economy of self-sufficient church estates, that somewhat resembled the situation in Paraguay I dealt with in an earlier lecture. Otherwise too, the numbers of missionaries in South America remained very small in the 16th century. In Mexico, there were never more than 300, and in Peru, they only arrived in the 60s of the 16th century, and they were even smaller in number. In the classification of religion I dealt with in the previous lecture, the Aztec and Maya religions were customary religions, though they were, some scholars argue, on the point of evolving into book religions. Now, book religions are very resistant to conversion, since you have in that case to reject not merely your religion wholesale, but also, and that is even for the converts difficult, many of the ethical values and the scientific views that come with the religion you reject. Customary religions, on the other hand, are far more accommodating to other religious views. Thus, a thing Westerners find very hard to grasp, most Japanese are Buddhist and Shinto at the same time. They may celebrate a Buddhist celebration on one occasion and a Shinto one on another. Mostly, the Buddhist celebration is more or less a religious celebration, while a Shinto celebration is more or less a social occasion. Now, similarly, and interestingly, we more or less know what the traditional Aztec priest thought about the Christian newcomers. As missionary Bernardo de Sahagún gives us a dialogue between the missionaries and the traditional priests. And the traditional priests say that were they to adopt that Jesus man, the social order of the Aztecs, based on the veneration of the old gods, would disintegrate, much as they would sever their ties with their own history if they converted, as these two went via their religion. The priest did not plead the old gods were right, or for that matter wrong. These gods represented the social order, and they were necessary for maintaining that order, whereby the Aztec priests actually made the very same argument as the French sociologist Émile Durkheim would make 400 years later. However, as we saw, the Aztec order began to disintegrate with a combination of intrusive species and old world diseases, the missionaries, Dominicans and Franciscans, later on joined by Jesuits and Augustinians, began to convert the Aztecs in masses. One missionary claimed he had baptized 40,000 people in a single year, and the Spaniards equally zealously demolished the old temples to erect new churches instead. Over three centuries, they managed to construct a staggering 12,000 churches in Mexico alone. Now, at first, this was obviously a very superficial conversion, since, as the missionaries themselves admitted, there was neither time nor occasion to thoroughly instruct people in the Christian faith. Mostly, such conversion consisted of throwing some holy water over a crowd of converts, or rapidly having them repeat some phrases. And often, such rapidly translated words were not grasped by the converts at all, or they caused enormous confusion. There is one anecdote in which Hernán Cortés, via his mistress and interpreter, Malinque, probably, instructed the town to worship Jesus and to maintain his horse. On coming back, he found they now worshipped his horse. And his censuses of the 1560s and the 1580s still list most inhabitants of Mexico as not being Christian or merely nominally Christian. They knew a few words, and otherwise they worshipped their old god. The situation in Peru was far worse from a missionary perspective. Yet over the very long run, as we move from the 16th into the 17th century, the identity of Mexico, and indeed much more slowly that of Peru too, indeed began to change, especially as there emerged a mestizo, a middle class between Spanish merchants and officials of mostly mixed Indian-Spanish blood, and the Indian population. Those mestizos began to stress their Catholicism, which made them stand out from the, to them, pagan peasants, and the mestizos increasingly meant the clergy. By 1600, you did not count as a mestizo family if there was not at least one friar or a nun in your family. And it was above all them the middle classes, who indeed managed to instill into Mexico's population a profound sense of being a deeply Catholic country, indeed. By the early 17th century, even Nahuatl-speaking peasants would have more or less considered themselves Catholic. Old Aztec gods were assimilated into Catholic saints, or assimilated with the figures from the Bible whom they the most closely resembled. Quetzalcoatl became Adam. Xalcuautlice became the Virgin Mary. Tlaloc became St. John the Baptist. Or better still, Aztec gods accommodated with the Christian religion. Much as Japanese ritual can be both Shinto and Buddhist, so too worship of the Aztec gods was for the peasants at once a celebration of Christian saints. In practice, the Catholic Church considered the policy of cautious adoption or somewhat hesitant assimilation best, and in particular, as they were newly converted, Indians were into the 18th century exempted from interrogation by the Inquisition. And yet, the Spaniards themselves often doubted whether what the Indians were celebrating could truly be called Catholicism. Missionary Diego Duran noted one procession where Aztec peasants were lining up to worship Christ, but they were carrying flowers instead of candles, and Duran thought they were really worshipping God Tezcatlipoca rather than Christ. And he wrote, "I see these things, but am silent, since I realize that the Spaniards feign ignorance. So I pick up my staff and my flowers like the rest, and I walk along, and I think of our great ignorance, for great evils may be concealed under these customs." Yet had the European missionaries ever really grasped the Aztecs, he wondered. Quote, "The Indians worship their own god, and yet we grasp nothing of what goes on in their chants, in their dances, in their bathhouses, in their marketplaces, in their repasts or banquets. All these things mean nothing to us." That was partly inherent to any colonial situation. In any colonial situation, there is always a large private sphere of the colonized population that has to be and remains beyond the gaze of the colonial authorities. For it was indeed precisely this that made colonialism bearable to colonizers as much as to colonized. The colonizer had, as it were, to allow a kind of privacy threshold of the colonized population, beyond which the colonial state was not allowed to venture or to step. Yet, in some ways, this also tallied with the situation in Europe, as the peasants there were also, to a large extent, beyond the control of the church or of the secular authorities. Many Spaniards, and particularly many of the mestizos, emphasized a utopian mix of Spanish and Aztec elements that would converge in a blending of culture that befitted the divine inspiration. In practice, however, Indians were increasingly marginalized as the native nobility, the bearer of Nahuatl language, worldview, and ritual, disintegrated. And yet surely not entirely so. The strangest case of the persistence of the Aztecs I have seen is that the daughter of Moctezuma married one of Cortes' captains, Cristobal Flores. The couple later on retreated to Spain, to Pizarro's native town of Cáceres. Incredibly, therefore, the Moctezuma family are now amongst the major landlords in the Spanish province of Extremadura. I would nearly term it a pact of elites, if it weren't so bizarre. On which anecdote, I'll close this episode to go on with the world of learning I started with in the previous lecture.